Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
So this meeting was an opportunity for all our members to come together, to share with each other what had worked, what had not worked, what were the changes that we needed to make, and how did we mean to make them.
The 13th Commonwealth Women's Affairs Ministers meeting ends in the Bahamas capital, Nassau.
What we are looking for is very simple. We're only looking for best working conditions.
Members of a teachers' trade union in Gabon want the winner of the presidential election to improve their working conditions.
There were administrative problems that exposed ZEC as an organization that is incapacitated and incapable to conduct a free and fair election in Zimbabwe.
And Zimbabweans anxiously wait for the outcome of the general election as police officers with water cannons guard the National Results Center. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The 13th Commonwealth Women's Affairs Ministers meeting has ended in the Bahamas capital, Nassau. Opened by the Secretary General Patricia Scotland, the three-day summit aimed to expedite efforts to attain gender equality as well as empower women and girls in climate action. The Women's Affairs Ministers also pledged to intensify efforts to address inequality in priority areas. They include women's economic empowerment, protections from gender-based violence, strengthening the role of women in climate finance, increased support for women with disabilities, and increased representation of women in decision-making. Analysts say recent disasters such as Cyclone Freddy in southeastern Africa have shown that women bear a disproportionate brunt of the impact due to gender inequalities. I reached Patricia Scotland via Skype to talk about the just concluded summit. Here is the first part of the conversation.
So this meeting was an opportunity for all our members to come together, to share with each other what had worked, what had not worked, what were the changes that we needed to make, and how did we mean to make them. So we came up at this meeting with a determination that we are creating a roadmap for change and improvement, and that we want to really monitor what each of us are doing so that every penny we spend, every pound, every rupee, every dollar, we will spend it only once, so that we will together be able to make faster improvement than any of us could make on our own. But the climate issue was really at the forefront of a lot of our members' mind. Look at what's happened today with the
talking about climate issues. In your estimation, talk to me briefly about how the climate crisis is disproportionately harming women. I hear about 80% of those displaced by climate change are women.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you look at all the data, it shows that women and girls, when any crisis comes, are the people who are most disadvantaged by these issues. And so we were looking at the statistics and we were concentrating on how do we reverse it? How do we make sure that people understand? And you will see that the Commonwealth has created four different templates, four different toolkits to help our countries to really take the steps they need for gender parity, gender equality, to create gender sensitive and gender relevant policies. Because we cannot allow this unfairness, this injustice to continue. And what we know is, as a result of working with our countries, we have come up with strategies which we know have worked. And so this is an opportunity for us to replicate. And I hope that you will highlight in this interview all the four initiatives and the programs that we have, because they do work. And we know that our countries hunger for the change.
Now, Madam Secretary General, why do you think women should be at the heart of climate action and development, and how to make that specifically happen?
I think we have to be at the heart because we are the ones who are most keenly affected by it. And if women are not to be left behind, they have to be part of the directing mind and will of those who are creating the solutions, because they feel it, and those who feel it know it. And we have to take advantage of that woman's experience. Women are still responsible for being the main caregivers for our children, but also they are the women who look after the home and therefore actually look after our men. So if women aren't empowered to do that which they are most able to do, then we won't succeed. We also know we need more women to be involved in our industries, to be involved in the trade. The small and medium-sized businesses predominantly are run by women and young people. So if we are to improve the economic position of our countries, we have to really support our women and our girls to be those change makers. And if we don't put them at the heart, we will never get the change we need. And, you know, if men want to do well, our women have to do well to enable that to happen. And we've seen that in all the data. So I think this meeting was focusing on the practical, on the pragmatic, on how do we get the data? How do we disaggregate the data? How do we share the data? How do we build the policies? And how do we change the reality in which too many of our women and children are sitting and being disadvantaged? And we found, unfortunately, that women who suffer from a disability are even more disadvantaged than anyone else. And so these realities are absolutely clear. But what we do know is if we come together, if we work in partnership, if we share, if we come and make the commitment, then we can be the difference we need to see in the world. And the Commonwealth has seen that time and time again. If you could think about where we were in 2016, the way we've come together to create a regenerative approach to climate change, the creation of the Blue Charter, the Living Lands Charter, the way that we have come together to look at how we have the Commonwealth Sustainable Energy Transition, the work we're doing on trade and oceans, which has done the created the connectivity agenda, the fact that we've grown the trade in the Commonwealth now to 721 billion, and we hope to get to 1 trillion by 2026 and get to 2 trillion by 2030. But to do that, we know we have to invest in our women and our girls. We have to enable them to participate in that economy so it can grow.
Patricia Scotland is the Commonwealth Secretary General. She spoke with me from Bahamas capital, Nassau. In Gabon, members of the teachers' trade union called CONASID want the winner of the just-concluded presidential election to improve their working conditions. This after voters choose a new president, legislative and local representative in elections on Saturday. Analysts say they expect the presidential contest between incumbent President Ali Bongo Ondimba and main challenger Albert Ondo Osa to be competitive. This after opposition groups made a decision to support Osa in the election. For more about the expectations of teachers from the winner of the presidential vote, I reached Cyprian Munguli. He is a member of the teachers' trade union called CONASID, but spoke independently of the group.
What we are looking for is very simple. We're only looking for best working conditions, best living conditions as well. By best working conditions, I mean, well-equipped school facilities, okay, with a reduced number of students in classrooms and so on and so forth, with all the facilities we need for better results in schools. the better pay as well, because you know that we can't work without being paid in return. We have got many teachers who've been working for more than 5 years without any salary, unfortunately. So we're looking forward so that our teachers be well treated after working.
So, Cyprien, has any of the two political groupings, talking about the government and the opposition party, have they been able to raise issues about the improved teaching conditions and living conditions of teachers in the country as they campaign for the elections?
For sure, yes. All the candidates say it. In previous years, many candidates promised to improve our conditions. But we hope that at the end of this election, these promises will come to reality.
I understand some trade unions and teacher groups are supporting one party or the other. Is your trade union supporting any of the candidates?
No, our trade union doesn't support any candidate, but individually, some teachers will vote for one candidate or another, okay? But officially, no communication has been made so that to invite teachers to vote one or another candidate.
In your estimation, how excited, how enthusiastic are people in Gabon to vote?
People want to see, let's say, new officials at the head of a state, of course. They want to see roads built, schools, hospitals, and so on and so forth, and even accommodation.
But President Ali Bongo Ondimba is saying that he has provided all these things and is doing more. The opposition says that, no. How are your members reacting to this?
We must recognize that many things have been done, okay? But we need more. So that since we are in a democracy, if another candidate becomes president, he will continue what has been done now.
Do people believe that the Electoral Commission will organize this election in a peaceful and transparent manner? Because the last time the elections were contested, former opposition leader Jinping said the elections were rigged. So what are the expectations here?
Of course, we hope that things will go better than in 2016. We don't know what God prepares. So we hope that things will be well done. But you can't say that it won't happen.
Cyprien Mungulu is a member of the teachers' trade union called CONASID. He spoke with me from the Gabonese capital, Libreville. In Zimbabwe, the main opposition Citizens Coalition for Change, or CCC, is calling on the Electoral Commission to ensure it releases only credible poll results. This after the party expressed a lack of confidence in how the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission, or ZEC, administers Wednesday's vote. Preliminary results show President Emmerson Mnangagwa and main challenger Nelson Chamisa are tied. But the CCC says the polls were fraught by poor organization, including the late arrival of poll materials and voter irregularities. Both the governing ZANU-PF and the Electoral Commission reject the accusations as without merit. For more about the concerns of the opposition as the electoral body releases results of the just-ended elections, I reach Promise Nkwananzi. He is the spokesperson for the CCC.
The election was a total shambolic disorganization. We are totally dissatisfied with the manner in which the election has been conducted thus far. There were administrative problems that exposed ZEC as an organization that is incapacitated and incapable to conduct a free and fair election in Zimbabwe. As you know, the ballot papers were delayed, elections, voting had to go on until the next day, and so on and so forth. In addition to that, the rigging that has taken place in the electoral process has been there for all to see, including election observer missions that have expressed their misgivings in terms of the credibility and the professionalism of this election.
Do you have proof of these allegations you are making?
These are not allegations. These are facts. The delay of the delivery of ballot papers, it was there. Everybody saw it. It's been confirmed even by election observer monitors from across the world. It has been roundly condemned. The presence of FARs in the electoral processes and their interference with electoral processes has been there for all to see. The violence, the intimidation, the issue of assisted voters, and all the manipulations that have been taking place, and the partial coverage of political parties by the state media. Everything is in the public domain. Everything is known. This election has not gone properly. It is an indelible stain which has far-reaching implications on the credibility and the legitimacy of the government that will come out of it. But nonetheless, we came into this election fully aware that ZANU-PF was unwilling and incapable of conducting a free and fair election. As a result, we came prepared to win an unfree and unfair election. And indeed, President Chamisa has prevailed despite the fact that the elections have not been free and fair.
Well, Promise, if the CCC lacks confidence in the ability of the Electoral Commission to administer credible elections like you have said, then what happens if Nelson Chamisa, your presidential candidate, is declared the winner?
If President Nelson Chamisa is declared the winner, he must be inaugurated to become the president of the Republic of Zimbabwe. It does not mean that the election would have been free and fair. He would have won an election that is not free and not fair based on the overwhelming support that he enjoys in the country. We have got no choice as CCC but to win an unfree and unfair election. And the indications on the ground show that despite all the shenanigans and machinations by the ZANU-PF party in collaboration with FARS and ZEC, still President Chamisa continues to prevail. Even our members of parliament, we have long surpassed the one-third threshold. We are now moving to attain two-thirds majority within parliament.
Where does the CCC go from here?
Well, we are monitoring the situation very closely. We continue to highlight the problems and challenges that are facing this election, and we are happy and that we are vindicated by the election observer missions. I think it's quite significant, particularly the position of the Southern African Development Community, SADC, which is in itself unprecedented over the last elections. It shows the evolution and the reformation of SADC into a modern democratic international body that is determined to oversee a credible governance in the region. So where we are going, we are saying we will continue to highlight these issues, but we are confident that in spite of it all, we have won this election. And the most honorable thing that Mr. Mnangagwa can do is to concede defeat and allow the winner of this election to be inaugurated accordingly.
Promise Nkwananzi is the spokesperson for the Zimbabwean Main Opposition Citizens Coalition for Change, or CCC. He spoke with me from the capital, Harare. Meanwhile, Zimbabweans waited anxiously Friday for the outcome of general election as dozens of armed police with water cannons guarded the National Resort Center, the scene of deadly violence after the previous vote 5 years ago. AP reports African election observer missions criticized this week's balloting, alleging that a group linked to the ruling ZANU-PF party had engaged in voter intimidation, while Zimbabwean authorities took dozens of local election monitors to court on allegations of subversion that government critics said were trumped up charges. Ricky Mukoza is professor for the Faculty of Humanities at Tshwane University of Technology, Polokwane, Limpopo, South Africa. He tells my colleague Douglas Mpuga that early results from the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission indicated that ZANU-PF was winning in its traditional rural strongholds, while the Citizens Coalition for Change was taking major urban areas that have traditionally voted for the opposition.
I think what we are seeing is the traditional trend where the main opposition political party, which is the Citizens Coalition for Change, is winning in the urban areas. Mostly constituencies that are in the urban areas are going to the opposition political party, except for a few rural constituencies. The majority of constituencies in the rural areas are going to the ruling party, which is ZANU-PF. But what also needs to be noted is that the margins with which ZANU-PF is winning in the rural areas are very big margins compared to the margins with which opposite political parties are winning in the urban area. So that then tells you that you are likely to have the ruling party winning overall.
That was almost expected by some people. So you're saying now the ruling party may pull this off?
This is what is coming out from the statistics that we have had so far. And yes, as I said earlier on, this is has been the trend in previous elections. And what we also are seeing is that the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission releases results of constituencies where opposition political parties would have won first. And then as they move along, they then bring out the full picture where a majority of the constituencies would have gone to the ruling party. So it's like we are watching an old script. That's what I've observed.
And what do you make of accusations to the ZEC for having messed up the polling where people had to vote in 2 days?
No, there are quite a number of transgressions that the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission have committed against the law. Firstly, they were supposed to have had ballot papers at polling stations 48 hours before the voting day. But we saw that mostly in urban voting polling stations, ballot papers did not arrive. In some cases, they then arrived midway through the day that people were voting. In some cases, they arrived when the voting day was about to end. That's why the president had to sign a special proclamation to extend the voting hours. We also saw they couldn't provide the voters' roll in a manner that those that are participating in elections can easily analyze the data. They failed in that regard. There were other transgressions that may not have had anything to do with ZEC, but that were taking place within the environment in which the elections were being conducted. For example, voter intimidation that we saw on different videos that were circulating, where people were being asked to write their name and make pledges that they are going to vote for a particular party and particular contestants. So if you add all that, and also we can't ignore the role of the Zimbabwe Republic Police, it's arbitrary arrest of opposition political supporters, it's disruption of rallies organized by opposition parties. The Zimbabwe Broadcasting Corporation, the public broadcaster, wasn't covering political parties equitably. So there are a whole lot of things that went wrong. But I don't think it was by mistake. I honestly think that it was part of the design of the whole system to ensure that the outcome of the elections go in a particular way.
But are you saying the results will not be credible, seen as being credible?
If people were to be really, really truthful and fair, these results cannot even pass the test of credibility on any day. And we can't in any way say these results were free or fair or credible.
Ricky Munkoza is professor for the Faculty of Humanities at Tshwane University of Technology, Polokwane, Limpopo, South Africa. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Polokwane, South Africa. Nigeria's President Bola Tinubu says a court petition seeking the release of his academic records from Chicago State University is not relevant and should be dismissed. This after former Vice President Atiku Abubakar, the presidential candidate for the main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP, petitioned a court to order the release of Tinubu's documents. The school had refused to release the document to Abubakar, saying it did not see the relevance of the certificate in the former vice president's challenge of Tinubu's victory in the last presidential election. This prompted the former vice president to seek legal redress to compel the university to release the academic files. Abubakar argues that the documents will settle the controversy surrounding the president's academic qualifications and help with his election challenge back home. The former vice president alleges that the last presidential election was fraught with irregularities and rigging. Tinubu's academic qualifications show that he graduated from Chicago State University with a bachelor's degree in business administration, accounting and management in 1979. Frank Shaibu is the special assistant on public communication to former vice president Atiku Abubakar. He talks to me about what he says is the relevance of Tinubu's academic records in the U.S. to the election petition.
His discovery is very relevant in all aspects, relevant in all phases, because as far as we are concerned, his records are public documents. And because these are public documents, the president of our country cannot be such a character who would parade a fake certificate, because that would mean represents a dent on our democracy. And it would suffer what I call a deficit internationally.
Well, he denies that the former vice president petition has anything to do with the election petition in Nigeria. But my question is, how has the conduct of the last presidential election in Nigeria affected public confidence in electoral processes in Nigeria from your perspective?
It has a lot affected public confidence, more so that Nigerians know that the election was stolen, that the man who was declared as their president was not the one they voted for. So it has eroded public confidence, you know, and the Nigerian judiciary has a historic opportunity before them at the elections petition tribunal, because they have been called out many times because of so many controversial judgments in the past. And this case provides a historic opportunity that will determine whether Nigeria will swim or sink. It is not about Atiku Abubakar being president of Nigeria. It's about the most populous black nation in the world, because illegitimacy plus illegality will produce what you call pluralistic illegalism. And that will not, such a character will not be respected world over, you know. So the judgment, the matter before the judiciary, before the esteemed justices of our judiciary, you know, it's historic. And the evidence before them is overwhelming. So Nigerians expect them to do the right thing, because the judgment will reset Nigeria. Nigerians will have a breather of life, both at home and abroad. And it will be something that will inspire Nigerians, both those who are abroad to return home to come and invest, you know, and those at home to know that, look, they have an opportunity to be proud of their own country.
On social media platforms, there are several memes with people saying all eyes on the judiciary in Nigeria. But what are the chances that the election petition court in Nigeria would see the outcome of the election in the light of what some people are saying, voter irregularities and rigging?
Well, the truth is, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yes. Is it the truth? With the evidence before the elections petition tribunal, and with the esteemed justices of the court, knowing full well that they have a historic opportunity, you know, to place their name, you know, in the science of time. They know that if you juxtapose that opportunity they have with the evidence before them in the public space, they know too well that the only option they have is for justice not to just be done, but to be seen to be done. failure, there are no fears at all, because we believe that justice will be served in this matter.
Frank Shaibu is the Special Assistant on Public Communication to former Vice President Atiku Abubakar. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Still in Nigeria, a prominent member of the Nigeria Bar Association says President Bola Tinubu violated the constitution with the first ministerial list he presented to the Senate for confirmation. Attorney Kunle Eden contends that the president failed to meet the requirement by submitting a list comprising 28 names instead of the required 37 names. He also asks that the Senate should not have vetted the ministers due to what he says was an illegal act. His remarks come after he filed a petition at the High Court in the capital, Abuja, seeking redress. The Constitution requires the president to have at least 37 ministers designate, each representing one of the 36 states, as well as one representing the federal capital, Abuja. Legal analysts say complying with the provisions of the Constitution should have been respected by the president because he swore an oath to protect the document. President Tinubu recently swore in his cabinet ministers, but critics say the lack of respect for the rule of law undermines democracy. Kunle Eden tells me the violation of the Constitution is a cause for concern to all Nigerians.
Court now. All right, so, Barrister Kunle, we understand that you and a colleague have filed a petition.
What we are saying by way of the action we filed in court at the Federal High Court here in Abuja is just a restatement of what is already stated in the Constitution of Nigeria, that upon the inauguration of the president and swearing to an oath of office, 60 days thereafter, he must transmit to the Senate of the National Assembly his list of ministerial nominees. And also, the same constitution also makes provision that every state in Nigeria, as a matter of fact, we have 36 states in Nigeria and the Federal Capital Territory, which is also defined to be a state. And the constitution provides that every state in Nigeria, including the Federal Capital Territory, must have a person representing the state in the cabinet of the president, that is an indigenous of the state, at least one person, indigenous of the state, must represent the state in the cabinet of the president. In that way, we are talking about 37, minimum 37 nominees who will now represent the 36 states and the Federal Capital Territory, Abuja.
Kunle, are you saying that the Senate itself abetted in this illegality?
Obviously. Of course, the Senate could accept the list, but not have acted on it, because at the stage where the 60 days had already expired, there was nothing the Senate could have done, or the Senate ought not have acted on it. Immediately, the 60 days expired, and the names submitted were not up to 37, or minimum of 37. The Senate ought to have stopped acting on it. But rather, they proceeded. And after the 60 days, the Senate was even justifying this aberration by saying that the president has promised that he will send another list outside the 60 days, which actually he did, and they acted on it outside the 60 days. So let us ask ourselves, why then did the fifth obstruction come in? So in essence, the whole essence of the fifth obstruction has been defeated. And by the way, do you know that many of the state governors also follow suit? Many of them did not even submit list of their commissioners to the various houses of assembly.
Are you therefore saying that the lack of respect or upholding the statute as expressly stated in the constitution could bring chaos and could create a crisis, so to speak, if things are not done according to the constitution?
Very well. Now, we are now back to the situation we were when Buhari ruled the country without ministers for more than 66 months or 7 months thereabout. We are now back to that same situation. Because what is the difference? In a sense, what could happen tomorrow is that probably in 4 years now, 8 years, I don't know how it's going to be, a new president comes in, And he will say, okay, Tinubu submitted 27 names, if I'm right, the first list, 27. Another president can say, okay, let me submit 10 names. Let me submit 5 names. Then after then, I will submit 20 names outside the 60 days. It's still all the same thing. Disrespect to the Constitution. The Constitution expects, what the Constitution actually expects is that you submit at least, since there are 36 states and the FCT Abuja, you submit at least 37 names of your ministerial nominees to the Senate of the National Assembly. That is the minimum. You could actually, there's a provision here that actually provides that the president can actually submit further names. Of course, he has that right. But you and I know very well that it's not issue of the number of ministers. You can actually have 37 ministers. But must all of them be given portfolio? We are talking about a country that is going down. Nigeria is suffering economically, but the cost of governance is still very, very high. For crying out loud, where are we going?
So Kunle, my question to you is, what are the prospects of success of this petition to the court? And when do you think the court can adjudicate this? Because the ministers have been sworn in and it appears life still goes on.
That is the pitiable situation where we find ourselves in this country. Many Nigerians, even scholars, they know very well that what Mr. President did is wrong. But you better check it out. Most people are not really bothered. And I always say that by the time we don't respect the rule of law, it will come crashing on us one day.
Attorney Kunle Eden is a prominent member of the Nigeria Bar Association. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. The Gender Center for Empowering Development, or GENCED, has petitioned the Economic Community of West African State, or ECOWAS, to consider the impact its decision would have on women and children in Niger. The NGO advocacy group for children and women say military interventions, including wars and coups, have harmed women and children who, it says, are marginalized in many parts of the world, including Africa. The remarks come after the regional bloc rejected the 3-year transitional period the military junta in Niger proposed to return the country to constitutional rule. ECOWAS has denounced the coup and has appointed former Nigerian leader General Abdul Salami Abubakar to lead its mediation effort to resolve the Niger crisis following the overthrow of Mohamed Bazoum. Esther Tayuya is the executive director of GENCED. She tells me that her organization will continue to engage with ECOWAS to ensure its decision about Niger as well as future crisis resolutions do not endanger women and children.
There are layers of humanitarian crisis that this could bring along. Niger and the other Sahel area, which this coup has been going on, Mali, Burkina Faso, are all high in issues about gender-based violence, early marriage, female genital mutilation. These issues are very high in these areas. Now, the moment there's a military takeover, constitutions are suspended, laws are suspended, everything in the country really does not work because the police is not really functioning as they ought to function. So who do these people report to? But you see, most of the coups that has happened, the response from ECOWAS has always been restoring of democratic principles, which is very important. But we think that ECOWAS have to go beyond that and begin to also look at some of the humanitarian crisis that comes about.
ECOWAS impose sanctions. Do you think that the sanctions negatively impact women and children more than the military junta?
Yeah, it would negatively impact women because, you see, we live in a society now where everything is integrated and we are like a village within a village, you know. So Ghanaians go to Niger to buy their onions and other commodities. Nigerians also come to Ghana for things. Go to Nigeria, go to Burkina Faso, go to Mali. Now, here is a case where the sanctions being placed on them, both road, land, and air is being closed. And so at the border, a lot of trucks that have loaded onions to neighboring countries are stuck over there. And these women who trade are losing millions of dollars from this sanction. So what then implies is that these women who are already vulnerable and trying as much as they can to do something for themselves are going to lose a huge money.
Is there any plan that your organization with other similar organizations
that have interest of women and children at heart to meet some of the organs of ECOWAS to push forward your request for them to consider some of these issues you've raised before imposing some of these restrictions when a legitimately elected government is overthrown, which attract the sanctions of ECOWAS?
Yeah, thank you. As a matter of fact, we've actually presented our petition to ECOWAS, and they've actually acknowledged our concerns and have assured us that they will further engage us on the way forward and how to go about the process and everything. So that's the very welcoming thing from ECOWAS, saying that we are ready for dialogue. We always want to do things better in the region. We can't say we know it all. You are also part of the stakeholders. So for me, that's a very good step. So when we send it to them, they quickly acknowledge and send back to us. So we are in communication with them. And we want to expand the conversation. We don't want to kind of have it only with ECOWAS, but also across board, even with the UN and the other organs. Because you see, when it happens, yes, we want to restore, but there are a lot of things, because the region that we find ourselves is embedded with so many problems. So it's like we are solving one problem, and then at the end of the day, we incur thousands of problems again. If you go to Liberia and you do a critical study, you realize that the civil war, not only did it end and democracy was restored, but it also had left so many social issues that today they are still battling with.
Esther Tyria is the executive director for GenZ. She spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Uganda, a founding member of the opposition party Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, is expressing concern about the challenges facing the group. Professor Maurice Ogenga Latigo, a former leader of the opposition in parliament, blames the leadership for the party's woes. Local media reports of tensions in the opposition party following demands by some members for the resignation of the leader and the general secretary. The members accused Patrick Oboye Amuriat and Nandala Mafabi of failing to properly account for funds since the last elections in 2021. Both reject the allegations. Supporters say the public dispute, if not immediately resolved, would cripple and subsequently splinter the party. Maurice Ogenga Latigo tells me that the lack of unity could derail the core aims of the FDC, which he says is to change politics in Uganda for the better.
The FDC as a national party is now in very turbulent waters. And the reason basically is because of the challenge that the party has had in terms of leadership since we first formed the party in 2005. There have been too much internal bickering, too much focus on who should be what within the party instead of putting hands together to move the party and use the party for what we thought it would be, to change the politics of Uganda and provide new direction for the country. So what you are seeing are actually personal squabbles. FDC as a party, the principles upon which it was formed, of looking at the country and saying one Uganda, one people, that principle still remains. FDC, as it was formed with the party platform that dealt with all issues related to agriculture, human resource development, the public service, local government, are basically intact. But the challenge is leadership.
So who is to blame for what is currently ongoing now? Because it appears that the founding father, Dr. Chisa Besigye, is in sharp disagreement with the current leadership, the president of the party and the general secretary of the party. So there appears to be two dividing teams within the FDC. A house divided among itself cannot stand, says the scripture.
Yes.
What say you?
You know, the two people to blame, they are not three. They are actually two. That is Dr. Besigye, as the founding president of FDC, and Nandala Mafabi, who was one of his closest confidants from the formation of the party. because the two of them used their positions in party not to bring every leader to participate, but they used it to fight. Many of us, the reason why I'm no longer active. As leader of opposition, people respected the things I was doing. The international community respected what I was doing. But my party leaders saw it as a threat. I have no interest in the presidency, but I have a big interest to serve the country. After that, General Muntu was fought when they brought in Engineer Muriat. Engineer Muriat did not want to become party president, replacing General Muntu on his own accord. He was brought in by Nandala and Dr. Besigye. Now that the sober minds are out of the party, these guys have remained there in the arena, and that is the fight between them is what is shaking FDC for the moment.
Do you see any healing process to bring the party together? Or are we going to see splinter groups basically obliterating the FDC as Ugandans know it?
What you would see in many of the events, the recent events that took place, what you would see are these old tired Ugandans quarreling amongst themselves. But the massive group of people who have gone there because they believe in FDC are young people. And Uganda is a very young country. Yes, the young people are disappointed. They want to be led by elders. But when the elders cannot do it, like we do in Africa, these elders will be put aside. And in that process, an opportunity to renew FDC would take place. I was invited for a meeting that I should have been in as a founding member to try and find a way forward. Unfortunately, I had a court case in my home area and I traveled upcountry. I await the outcome of that meeting, and some of us who have no interest in power, but we have a responsibility to our country and we love Uganda, we love its people, we will put our hands together and see how to salvage FDC from the hands of these selfish individuals and move the party forward.
Professor Maurice Ogenga Latigo is a founding member of Uganda's Opposition Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Mozambique's defense ministry says the armed forces have killed the alleged leader of an Islamic State-linked insurgency concentrated in the gas-rich northern Cabo Delgado province. According to Reuters, Bonamadi Machude Omar, also known as Abu Suleifa Muhammad and Ibn Omar, was killed along with two associates. Mozambique's President Philippe Nyusi said on Friday that Omar had been killed on Tuesday. The U.S. State Department says Omar was the head of the Military and External Affairs Department of the ISIS Mozambique Group. He was also responsible for attacks in Cabo Delgado in the town of Palma in March 2021. Those assaults led the French company Total Energies to close a liquefied natural gas project worth about $20 billion. The insurgency, which has been raging since 2017, has claimed thousands of lives. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
Come from the Wintula, Mabuli and Mbuz. Mbuz is angry. Ni na
Music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Impuga, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, remember Pepe has a beautiful face but an ugly temper. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.